The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
From Public Radio International, this is The World. A co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. It's Monday, August 8th. I'm Lisa Mullins in Boston. Today, the Syrian army presses ahead with an assault on the eastern city of Deir al-Zour, and residents of one of London's poorest areas experience unprecedented rioting.
We've never seen anything like this in the last 20 years. It's a disruption of service, of life, and of businesses.
Also, why China wants the U.S. to get its financial house in order.
Why should poor Chinese be lending money to us so that we can spend more than our income?
PRI's The World is brought to you with support from Medtronic, leveraging products, people, and philanthropy to help lessen the global impact of chronic non-communicable diseases such as diabetes and heart disease, and announcing that this September, world leaders will come together at the United Nations to chart a global response to this health issue. Learn more at Medtronic.com.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World. British police are struggling to contain the spread of violence and looting going on in London. The riots began Saturday night. They erupted amid community anger over the recent shooting death of a man by police. The rioting continued in the British capital yesterday, and today, young people with baseball bats smashed shop windows and hurled objects at police officers. What's more, skirmishes between police and young people have now broken out in Britain's central city of Birmingham. The World's Laura Lynch is in London now. The escalation, Laura, apparently is no longer an issue just affecting London. What are you hearing?
Lisa, it's getting quite hard to keep up with all the places where the violence is breaking out. And I don't know if you can hear in the background, but right behind me right now, there is the sound of a siren. I've heard quite a few of them in the last few hours. The violence started to break out again late this afternoon in eastern London. Then we heard about problems in two neighborhoods in the southern parts of London, and now further south of London, there are several shops set ablaze. All of these instances of violence seem to have one thing in common, and that is confrontations between young people, mainly seen as young male teenagers, and the police. They're throwing bricks at the police and rocks and anything they can get their hands on. When they're not doing that, they are looting stores or setting things ablaze. It's hard to see this as a protest movement of any sort, as much as it is young men trying to make trouble and trying to get goods out of stores, walking away with whatever they can. Now that it's gone up to Birmingham, we're seeing much the same thing happening up there. And so for the police, this was already a challenging time, and it's becoming more challenging as the hours go on.
Well, as you say, it seems to be opportunistic and kind of copycat activity right now, but what sparked this in the first place?
What sparked this initially was last Thursday when a young man was killed by the police in the community of Tottenham, a very deprived community in North London. His family staged a peaceful protest outside the police headquarters in Tottenham on Saturday night, saying they were not receiving enough information about why he had died and how he had died. Now, that was already going to increase tensions in a community where there are still lingering tensions between people and the police. He was a black man. They've always been somewhat suspicious of police. And so that seemed to be what triggered off the riots in Tottenham. And they were severe. There were a number of businesses destroyed. A building that was created in the 1930s that was seen as a heritage building is now going to be demolished because it simply cannot be kept standing. People have been evacuated from their homes. I was up there today, and I know a lot of people there were dismayed, were angry at what they had seen happen to their community, and were struggling to come together to send out another message. I met a minister there named Segun Johnson, who looked around and said he was just dismayed at what he saw.
We've never seen anything like this in the last 20 years. It's a disruption of life and of businesses. And we believe that this is not a true representation of the silent majority. They are just criminals But definitely is not the London that is waiting for Olympics to happen.
Well, certainly police and government officials have to have that same worry that the minister mentioned there. The Olympics are coming up in 2012. You've got to think also a lot of people coming to London as tourists this summertime. Any particular reason for concern for them?
Well, I think so. I mean, London's image is everything. This country lives on tourism, and to an extent, the rest of the country does too. So, of course, this kind of thing looks terribly bad. And for the police, who admit they have a huge policing task ahead of them next year, trying to meet this challenge is all the more important. And I think you've seen that kind of concern manifested today in the fact that the mayor of London, Boris Johnson, has announced that he's cutting short his vacation to get back here and try to contend with this. As well, the main minister responsible for policing in the government, she has come home as well. So great concern here that they have to get this under control, not just for the safety of the people, but for the image of London, because London is not looking very good right now.
All right. The world's Laura Lynch on the violence in London and elsewhere. Thank you very much, Laura. 5 months into the crackdown on the Syrian opposition, President Bashar al-Assad seems to be feeling the heat. Protests are spreading, and now three Arab allies have pulled their ambassadors from Damascus. And today, al-Assad appointed a new defense minister. The military has played a leading role in suppressing demonstrators. More deaths were reported yesterday from the town of Deir al-Zour, as Ben Gilbert reports.
Deir al-Zour had become one of the few towns largely taken over by protesters in the five-month uprising against Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's government. But this weekend, Assad's troops struck back. In this video posted by activists, machine gun fire and loud explosions can be heard in Deir al-Zour. Other videos show smoke rising from the city's skyline as tanks, armored personnel carriers, and heavily armed troops move in. Rami Abdulrahman from the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights in London says between 11 and 16 people have been killed in Deir al-Zour. He says two women and a child were killed today in an army assault that lasted 90 minutes.
After that, Syrian intelligence and security forces came and started arresting the people, about 34 people. Now it's quiet. Now there's nothing special at all.
Abdulrahman says that despite the fighting, the Syrian government still isn't in control of Deir al-Zour. Syrian officials say troops entered the city at the request of local tribal leaders. They claim that in Deir al-Zour, as in most cities in Syria, the problem is that convicts, criminals, and armed Islamist terrorists are trying to take over. Syrian protesters say that they are peaceful, unarmed, and want Assad and his regime to step down.
A new savage massacre committed by armed gangs which threw the mutilated bodies of 17 martyrs into the river.
The assault on Deir al-Zour was big news on Arab and English satellite channels today, but not for the Syrian state news agency. Instead, its English language news led with a story from the city of Hama. Activists say the Syrian army killed scores of people there. The Syrian government portrays things differently.
The Hama hospital received the bodies of 17 martyrs murdered and mutilated by armed gangs of terrorism, who threw the bodies into the Orontes River.
What followed was video of the bodies being taken from the water and into the morgue. It's not clear who killed them or why. They could be protesters killed by Syrian security forces, or they could be Syrian security forces killed by protesters. Syrian state TV eventually mentioned Deir al-Zour 8 minutes into the broadcast. It showed an interview with a Syrian police officer who claimed he and his partner were captured and beaten by an armed gang. The announcer said the police officers were forced to make false statements to satellite TV stations whose, quote, aim is to sow chaos and sedition in Syria.
They beat us up and threatened to kill us with explosives and to send parts of our bodies to our families. The gangsters had large amounts of weapons in the house. They tortured us, beat us up, and buried cigarette spots in our bodies and faces.
What definitely wasn't on Syrian state TV was the news that Kuwait, Bahrain, and Saudi Arabia withdrew their ambassadors today from Damascus. Saudi King Abdullah issued a statement this morning condemning the Syrian government's, quote, killing machine, and called for Assad to make meaningful reforms. Either Syria chooses wisdom on its own, or it will be pulled down into the depths of turmoil and loss, the king's statement said. The condemnation comes after the Arab League and Gulf states issued similar calls this weekend for an end to the Syrian government's crackdown. But Saudi Arabia's call is by far the most critical of any single Arab nation. Saudi Arabia views itself as the leader of the Sunni Muslims in the Arab world. Sunnis have by default been the core of the uprising in Syria. They make up around 75% of the population, while the government is dominated by President Bashar al-Assad's minority Alawite Muslim sect. Both sides accuse each other of trying to stir up sectarian tensions. Rami Abdulrahman says that as the conflict drags on, the divisions are becoming more pronounced.
Inside Syria, people are starting to talk religion now. It's very dangerous when people start talking about religious division.
So far, international condemnation of the Syrian government's actions has had little result, and it's questionable whether the Gulf Arab states' critical words and actions will have any effect either. The Turkish foreign minister is also slated to visit Damascus this week to deliver a firm message that Ankara's patience has worn out. A Syrian official said the Turks, Syria's neighbor and largest trading partner, would be met with a firmer reply. For the World, I'm Ben Gilbert in Beirut.
To Wall Street now, where the Dow Jones dropped 635 points today to close at 10,810, a more than 5.5% drop. Investors fear America could slip back into recession and that Europe's debt crisis could worsen. Add to that the downgrading by Standard & Poor's of the U.S. debt to AA+. President Obama points out that on that matter, opinions differ.
The markets, on the other hand, continue to believe our credit status is AAA. In fact, Warren Buffett, who knows a thing or two about good investments, said, if there were a quadruple A rating, I'd give the United States that. I and most of the world's investors agree. That doesn't mean we don't have a problem.
No other country is more eager than China for a solution to America's deficit problem. No other foreign country owns more of America's debt. Nick Lardy is with the Peterson Institute for International Economics, and he says China is watching Washington closely.
China cares primarily about the value of its treasury holdings. These are massive, far and away the largest in the world. They're the biggest foreign holder. And they don't want the purchasing power of those assets to decline. And if we don't get a solution to our debt, we're likely to move into a period of much higher inflation and other things that would erode the value of those assets for the Chinese. So I think that's their main concern.
So bring that home then. What do we, the lay people, care about what China feels about our carrying too much debt?
I think, quite frankly, there's an alignment of interest between the average American and the Chinese government. I think the average American probably thinks that we have too much debt and we need to do something to bring it down to a more manageable size over an appropriate time period, which is just about exactly what the Chinese are saying. So I don't think there is a need to worry that the Chinese are going to do something in response to our debt situation that would adversely impact us.
I'm sure you heard that China's ruling Communist Party in the official newspaper lambasted the United States for its credit rating downgrade and called for better coordination between the West and developing nations when it comes to economic policy. This kind of lecturing, is this unusual and is this something that the administration and Congress pay attention to?
The interesting thing is that China didn't say very much at all during the debate in Congress about raising the debt ceiling and the possibility of a default. They were playing it very, very low key. Once the downgrade, however, came on late Friday afternoon, then the Chinese did start to make, the official media started to make some comments over the weekend that they then strengthened further. I think it's really a reflection of domestic politics in China that critics of the Chinese government are saying, why are we piling up all these foreign exchange reserves? Essentially, what that means is China, a country where the per capita income is only about $3,000 or $4,000, is lending trillions and trillions of dollars to the United States, where the per capita income is 10 times higher. Why should poor Chinese be lending money to us so that we can spend more than our income? And in part to get ahead of that criticism, the government started criticizing the U.S. government for its budgetary policies and its excessive debt.
And one would think that on this end, that kind of lecturing might be received as would a credit card company chastising you for borrowing too much, having put up your credit limit multiple times.
Well, I think that is a good analogy because China did not have to lend us the money. They've lent us the money because they have been intervening in the foreign exchange market, keeping their currency undervalued, running massive trade surpluses. And when you do that, you inevitably build up a lot of foreign exchange reserves. I mean, you can't have it both ways. So if China wants to have a smaller quantity of reserves, that is, lend less money to us, all they have to do is let their currency appreciate, and that's the result they would get.
All right, Nick Lardy, Senior Fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington. Thank you, Nick.
Okay, thank you, Lisa.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, leveraging products, people, and philanthropy to help lessen the global impact of chronic non-communicable diseases such as diabetes and heart disease, and announcing that this September, world leaders will come together at the United Nations to chart a global response to this health issue. Learn more at Medtronic.com.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World. In the mid-19th century, there were 150 glaciers in Glacier National Park. Today, there are 25. The culprit is global warming, and the victims are not confined to the United States. The South American country of Colombia has its own Glacier National Park, and it's facing the same problem. Reporter John Otis takes us to Nevados Park.
15,000 feet high in the Andes Mountains, Jorge Ceballos climbs the windswept edge of Nevado Santa Isabel, one of Colombia's rapidly disappearing glaciers. Ceballos works for the government's Hydrology and Meteorology Institute and is Colombia's top expert on glaciers. He's found his way back to an 18-foot-long measuring stick that was buried in the ice here a little more than 2 years ago. Since then, so much of the glacier has melted that all but 3 feet of the stick are now exposed. If you come back next year, Ceballos says, the entire thing will be exposed. Isn't that incredible? In the 1800s, there were 19 glaciers in Colombia. Today, there are only six left, and Ceballos says they're losing 3 to 5% of their ice every year. At this rate, he says, they'll be gone by mid-century. Santa Isabel likely will be the next to go due to its relatively low altitude and small size of just 3 square miles. Dozens of rivulets already carry meltwater down to the slopes below. There are several reasons for what's happening here. Ceballos says one culprit is ash from a nearby active volcano, which settles on the ice and accelerates melting. But he says the main problem is global warming. 50 years ago, he says, the park's glaciers began at 13,500 feet. Ceballos says, now it rains at that altitude. Due to rising temperatures, we have to climb farther and farther up the mountains to find snow and ice. Glacial retreat receives more attention in neighboring Peru, where the massive ice cap is critical for the water supply. By contrast, Colombia has plenty of water, but very little ice and snow. Here, people's attachment to glaciers is more emotional. Juan Pablo Gomez is a guide at Nevados Park. Gomez says the glaciers provide a rare chance for Colombians to touch natural ice and play in the snow, and that they come away awestruck. It's like the first time you see the ocean, Gomez says. Many people cry. Others hug me and say, thank you so much. You've made my dream come true. For returning visitors to Nevados Park, the shrinkage of the glaciers has been shocking.
I told everything was the same, but it wasn't.
Colombian oil worker Johnny Reyes remembers exploring the park's vast network of ice caves a decade ago. But when he came back recently, guides told him they've melted.
The first question was, still got the caves? No, the caves not anymore. So I got really sad that day. So I said, I got my pictures. It's like, keeping your picture with you, because that's the best you're going to have.
Nevados Park draws 60,000 visitors a year, but Ranger Gabriel Echeverri wonders whether tourists will come to a glacier park with no glaciers. He suggests a rather desperate alternative. He says, we could stock the park with deer, so tourists would have a reason to come. But there might not be much more that Colombia can do, since the warming temperatures are largely the responsibility of the U.S., China, and other industrial giants. That leaves Jorge Ceballos focused on the sad task of documenting the glacier's disappearance.
Nuestros hijos o nuestros nietos.
Ceballos says our children and grandchildren will look at photos of glaciers and ask, what happened? Why did they melt?
¿Qué pasó? ¿Qué hicieron?
Ceballos and his team of assistants climb Santa Isabel every other month to dig into the snow and collect samples. Colombia has just gone through 18 months of cold temperatures and extraordinary precipitation provoked by the recent La Niña weather phenomenon. Thanks to La Niña, the top of Santa Isabel, at 16,000 feet, has actually accumulated 5 more feet of snow.
527.
Even better, the samples indicate the snow is turning into longer-lasting ice. Still, La Niña is over. Warmer weather is on the way, and Ceballos suspects the buildup won't last. In fact, he's so concerned about protecting what little ice remains that his exhausted team spends its last hour on the summit carefully shoveling snow back into all the test holes they've dug before heading back down. For The World, I'm John Otis, Nevados National Park, Colombia.
So what would you call the Nevados National Park or Glacier National Park in Montana when the glaciers are gone? You can share your thoughts with us at theworld.org. An old European tradition figures in today's GeoQuiz. According to a German custom, the valse, carpenters, blacksmiths, and other craftspeople hit the road to sharpen their skills. The journeymen volunteer in exchange for a chance to work alongside a master craftsman. Now, one city where you might still find this tradition is in eastern Germany. It's about 50 miles from the border with Poland. It's Germany's largest city, so big it's considered one of Germany's 16 states. There are still plenty of carpenters and glass blowers and bakers in the city to carry on the tradition of the wandering journeyman. We're going to tell you about a modern-day journeywoman when we reveal the answer a little bit later in the program. Before we take a break, here's a quick update on a story we did back in February. That's when a dance mix video featuring a fist-waving Muammar Gaddafi went viral. The remix was the work of an Israeli producer, Noy Alush. He says that the Libyan leader's shouts of Zenga Zenga, or Ali by Ali, reminded him of a dance track. Well, now Alush has taken inspiration from another arm-waving leader, this one closer to home. Alush's new video is called Bibi Shake Shake, and it features Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, or Bibi.
Everything is shake, shake, shake.
Good lyrics. In the video, you see Netanyahu in an interview spliced with scenes of Israelis out on the streets. Alush is taking aim at Netanyahu's comments that the kinds of uprisings seen in Arab countries won't happen in Israel. This past weekend, more than 100,000 Israelis went out to protest the high cost of housing, education, and health care. And many of them say that they've taken their inspiration from the Arab Spring uprisings. They say they're not looking to overthrow the government, but they do say they won't go home until they get what they want.
No protests. That's Israel. I mean, look at this. Earth shaking everywhere, from west of India right up to the Straits of Gibraltar. Everything is... The only stable country is this democracy, Israel. A developed country, prosperous country. Everybody's equal under the law. It has a strong military because it has a strong society.
This is The World on PRI. I'm Lisa Mullins. Coming up on The World, Chinook helicopters flying low and slow in Afghanistan are tempting for the militants.
They are big, fat targets for the Taliban, especially when they're taking off and landing.
The Taliban hit one Saturday and killed 30 Americans and 8 others. Also, German web designers carry on a 600-year-old tradition.
PRI's The World is brought to you with support from Medtronic, leveraging products, people, and philanthropy to help lessen the global impact of chronic non-communicable diseases such as diabetes and heart disease, and announcing that this September, world leaders will come together at the United Nations to chart a global response to this health issue. Learn more at Medtronic.com.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. The Pentagon today tried to ease concerns about a Taliban resurgence. Anxiety about the war grew this weekend when a helicopter with 38 troops, including 30 Americans, crashed in Afghanistan. All 38 died. The Taliban said it shot down the helicopter with a rocket. NATO would not confirm this claim. Today, President Barack Obama paid tribute to the fallen troops.
Their loss is a stark reminder of the risks that our men and women in uniform take every single day on behalf of their country. Day after day, night after night, they carry out missions like this in the face of enemy fire and grave danger.
That's President Obama speaking at the White House this afternoon. Noah Shachtman is a contributing editor at Wired magazine and the editor of its national security blog called Danger Room. Noah Shachtman, I know that you have been in these Chinook 47 helicopters with the double rotas. These are, in your words, kind of flying school buses. You seem surprised that we don't hear about more accidents like this happening. Why don't we?
Right. These Chinooks, they're almost 100 feet long, and they can carry up to 38 passengers. Compare that to the Black Hawk helicopter, which can only carry 11. So these things carry three times as much. They are big, fat targets for the Taliban, especially when they're taking off and landing. And so, yeah, I guess I'm a little surprised we haven't seen more of these incidents, and I'm concerned that we may see more in the future.
Why would we?
There's almost no good roads in Afghanistan. There's only one major highway. And U.S. troops, even though there's a lot of them right now because of Obama's surge, they're still really spread out. So really the only way to get quickly from point A to point B is in a helicopter. Add to that that the focus in Afghanistan has gone more from a counterinsurgency to these special operations capture or kill missions, kind of like the one we saw to go get Osama bin Laden. The only way to get special operations forces into an area quickly is in these helicopters. And so the more of these missions you fly, the more chances there are for either a catastrophic accident or for one of them being shot down.
And what about the weaponry itself? Because we don't really know at this point, but believed it was this improvised rocket-assisted mortar. If it's along the lines of the RPGs, it's something that cannot very well be targeted. These are notoriously dumb weapons. Is there anything that can be done to lessen the vulnerability to even weapons that are not very well aimed?
Right, Lisa. The irony is that the dumber the weapon, the harder it is to stop. U.S. helicopters are equipped with all kinds of chaff and flare and even lasers that can mess up the guidance system of more sophisticated weapons because they use heat-seeking missiles, for example. But these dumb weapons that are just kind of fire and forget, they are harder to stop. The U.S. military is working on something to stop these. It's a combination of a set of microphones, basically, that can listen for where an RPG is coming from, and then a laser that would blind the guy shooting it. It wouldn't get the first improvised rocket necessarily, but it might get the second one. And given that these things are pretty hard to aim, getting the second one or the third one or the fourth one would at least be an improvement over what we've got now, which is nothing.
I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is that when these helicopters fly slow and low as they do, that they are from point A to point B being targeted all the time.
I think they're being targeted. They may not be being fired on, but they are being targeted. And when you talk to pilots that fly in Afghanistan, they say their best defense really is to fly at night, is to fly low and close to the ground and along the curvature of the earth so that they don't make for such a good target, and is to use deceptive tactics like flying into a place and flying out of a place at different angles and using different vectors of approach.
Isn't that what happened this time, though? I think it was like 3 a.m. when they were coming back from a rescue mission.
Yeah, right. So you can use all the evasive maneuvers you want. You can use all the smart tactics you want. But at the end of the day, it may not be enough.
All right. Thank you very much, Noah Shachman, contributing editor at Wired Magazine and a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution's 21st Century Defense Initiative. Thank you, Noah.
Thanks for having me.
The wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have cost the United States between $2.3 and $2.6 trillion, and that's not counting another $1 trillion in obligations to veterans during the next 40 years. These figures come from a new research project by the Watson Institute for International Studies at Brown University. Boston University professor Nita Crawford was co-director of the study. It's not surprising, she says, that the price tag of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq is higher than what's been reported.
In nearly every conflict, it's common for public officials as well as the media and the general public to underestimate both the duration and the budgetary costs of war.
So what was the most surprising figure or a set of figures for you?
Most surprising for me were the costs over the long run of caring for veterans' medical and disability. Now, the U.S. has already spent on veterans who've come through the pipeline to go into the VA system over $30 billion. Now, if you take that into the future to the veterans who leave the service now and into the future, the cost will be between $600 billion and $1 trillion more in their medical and disability expenses over the next 30 to 40 years.
How do you get that figure?
Well, Linda Bilmes, an economist at Harvard, did the research on that, and she found two interesting things. One is that the soldiers are using medical benefits sooner than in other conflicts, and they're using more of them. So this greater draw on resources sooner is going to drive up the cost of veterans' care.
The way this was put together, I mean, the numbers as you have right now for Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, those wars, the price tag is $3.6 trillion. The value of that number is what? What does that tell us?
Well, it tells us a couple of things. First, that we've underestimated and not counted important costs of these wars.
What are we told the cost is? How different is this from what we're told by the government?
Well, the Congressional Research Service has done an analysis of the cost of the war in terms of Pentagon spending, and they tell us it's about $1.2 trillion for the last 10 years in post-9/11 related war making.
So what did you uncover in this study that previously you would not have been able to? I mean, was there something that you were able to access or figure out that you wouldn't have had before?
What we did was we put two and two together. We added things up. There's a tendency, I think, to look at these costs and consequences in a piecemeal way, and then you don't get a comprehensive picture of the death and the expenses. That, I think, is a contribution. In addition, I hadn't really thought about the consequences of borrowing to pay for the war. Most of the, in fact, every war the United States has fought in the past has been paid for at the time by increasing taxes or doing something like selling war bonds, treasury bonds. In this case, the U.S. has borrowed most of, if not all, of the money for the war, and that has enormous implications down the line.
And until recently, the wars weren't even put in the federal budget.
They weren't put in the regular budget. They were supplemental and emergency appropriations, which means they don't get as much scrutiny as they could. But there are many uncounted sort of ripple effects, not just here, but as well in the war zones. What I found startling was our lack of understanding of the indirect deaths caused by these wars. In other words, when infrastructure is destroyed, when people can't get to hospitals, when they don't have safe drinking water, people die. Or they're malnourished and are more vulnerable to disease.
And could so you count that as a direct cause of war?
You can make a guess, and that's all it can be, because there's not enough research done on this. For example, the Geneva Secretariat did research looking at many conflicts over the world, including the current ones in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan. And they found that anywhere between a ratio of 4 times more people die as an indirect effect of conflict or 15 times more. Mm-hmm. Now, I could tell you that roughly 125,000 Iraqis were killed as a direct result of violence. But then if I tell you that between 4 and 15 times more people were killed indirectly, that's just an enormous range. So we didn't include indirect death in our discussion in terms of numbers, but we want to talk about it in terms of cause.
In terms of cause, not cost.
Right. In terms of the consequence of using force and destroying infrastructure is that people die indirectly, nonviolently, from war.
Same thing with military people, too. I mean, there are things that happen that are not on the battlefield.
Correct. For example, when a soldier comes back and is under great stress, there's stress to their family. Those are non-quantifiable. We know that in 2003, for example, there were more suicides among soldiers than people died on the battlefield. Now, that you can quantify, but there's an enormous amount of suffering that continues. That, in other words, the war's not over when the bullets stop flying. After, let's say, a ceasefire or withdrawal, the same thing with these indirect effects in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. They will continue for years after the U.S. withdraws from Afghanistan and Iraq.
Nita Crawford is co-author of a new study by Brown University entitled The Costs of War. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, our GeoQuiz today, which has us looking for a German city that doubles as a state. The answer is Berlin. Now, walk by a construction site in Berlin and you might see a few people dressed in floppy black hats, bell-bottom corduroy pants, and black vests. This is the uniform of the wandering craftsmen. These craftsmen are newly trained in fields such as carpentry and bricklaying. Every year, hundreds of them hit the road to develop their skills. It's a 600-year-old tradition. But as Caitlin Carroll reports, it has a few new twists.
Sylvia Fritsche checks herself out in a full-length mirror. She's in a small store in Berlin, trying on the traditional uniform of a wandering journeyman or Wandergeselle.
Ich habe eine Hose in dieser Farbe eigentlich und die ist dunkler.
The owner helps Fritsche decide on sizes and colors as he pins and tailors the shirt. Fritsche says the Wandergeselle tradition goes back to the Middle Ages.
Basically, it's for craftsmen who had to travel for 3 years and one day after their apprentice.
In the past, guilds would force tradesmen to leave cities after their apprenticeships ended to protect the jobs of resident craftsmen. These newly trained workers developed the practice of going auf der Walz, which literally means on the roll. The tradition comes with traditional rules. The wanderers must be single and under 30. They travel with few possessions and barter their work for a bed and a meal. And they're not supposed to come within 31 miles of home for 3 years and a day.
I actually changed the tradition. I can't travel for 3 years. I think my money doesn't last that long.
Fritsche is breaking from traditions in other ways, too. She's only wearing part of the uniform, just the hat, shirt, and vest. She's one of the few women who make the journey. About 90% of the Wandergesellen are men. And she knows more about computers than carpentry, which is a web concept developer and designer.
Professionally, I really hope to gain a lot of knowledge about graphic design in other countries. And privately, yeah, I hope that it will just change me a little bit, actually. I hope for that, yeah.
In the early 90s, the number of Wandergesellen rose as stable jobs dwindled in the wake of German reunification. Germany's current unemployment rate is low, but about 600 to 800 people a year still follow the tradition. And now young trainees in fields like computer design, ceramics, culinary arts, and music are adopting this history of working on the road as a way to learn their craft. Conventional craftsmen still form the core of the wanderers. A group of former and current wandering carpenters gathers at a neighborhood festival in Berlin to swap stories, have a beer, and demonstrate some of their skills to passersby. Robert Evans returned from wandering a few years ago. He says he learned something from every country and building site.
You can pick up the best from all.
But for Evans, the payoff was more fundamental. It changed the way he sees life.
If you made your traveling, you are not afraid on your existence. You know that the life goes every time on. It doesn't matter what happens. It goes on until your body don't.
So even though he had some hard times on the road,
I always say do it. When you are free, no family, go. It's the best you can do.
Most Europeans understand the practice, but on other continents it's more confusing. Another former wanderer, Stefan Kottner, says he had a book listing which places would be familiar with the tradition, but he says he answered a lot of questions while he waited on street corners for carpentry jobs.
You're Amish people? This is the first question when I get from the American people. You're Amish people? And they said, no, different.
Sylvia Fritsche anticipates that confusion, so she crafted her website to explain the tradition of going on vaults to her potential employers.
I wanted them not just to think via email, this is a weird German girl who just wants to have an internship. I wanted to have to make a space for them to also ask questions.
She says many design firms still hang up on her, but she's confident she can win them over.
At least they would perhaps understand a little bit German culture and not just think about a country which has this black past, but we have also nice things here. And I hope that they get something positive out of it.
Fritsche heads out later this month. She plans to wander and work in Asia, the United States, and South America. Her path isn't totally clear yet, but that's kind of the point. For The World, I'm Caitlin Carroll in Berlin.
A mystery tomorrow on The World. A retired British police detective is on the trail of Jack the Ripper.
It's probably one of the great unsolved mysteries of British criminal history.
Detective Trevor Marriott thinks old police files from the era could help crack the case, but despite his Freedom of Information request, the documents remain locked away. The secret files on Jack the Ripper, tomorrow, right here on The World. This is PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World. Temperatures in South Korea are hitting the mid-80s these days. South Korean foodies beat the heat with a bowl of cold noodles. The noodles of choice, more and more, are a North Korean dish known as naengmyeon. North Korean refugees brought the dish south during the Korean War. It's becoming more popular now because more recent defectors from the North are opening up their own restaurants. Reporter Jason Strother takes us to lunch in Seoul.
Ryu Kyung Oak fills up quickly during lunchtime. The menu at this tiny restaurant takes you on a gastronomical tour of North Korea. There's dumpling soup from Kaesong, a rice and beef dish from Pyongyang, and naengmyeon from Hamhung. That last item is what many customers come for. I'm here with my friend Ro Soo-ha. She says naengmyeon is just what you want on a steamy summer day.
When it's really hot, it's just really refreshing and it tastes good and it kind of cools down your whole body.
Ro orders one bowl of naengmyeon served in a cold beef broth, another mixed with raw fish and pepper sauce. All the staff at Ryu Kyung Oak are North Korean defectors, including the owner, An Mi-ok. North Korean food is really simple compared to South Korean food, An says. We use the traditional ways of cooking and don't add unnecessary ingredients. Here, they use so much artificial flavoring or add extra types of sauces. North Korean food gets back to the basics. While naengmyeon has been popular in South Korea for decades, An hopes other North Korean dishes will soon catch on. 47-year-old Lee Ae-ran is also counting on that. Lee is a former food inspector from Pyongyang. She now runs the North Korean Food Institute in Seoul. She says cooking is a great way for Koreans from both sides of the peninsula to overcome their differences.
The problem is that North and South Korean people have had no communication since we were separated. But our love of food is universal. Cooking provides a place for both of us to come together and chat over cooking or eating and talk about food.
Recently, Lee's school started offering classes in English so non-Korean speakers can talk about North Korean food too.
Okay, once the rice starts to boil and it starts bubbling, things start bubbling, you want to mix it once.
With the help of an interpreter, Lee instructs the class on how to make haeju bibimbap, a North Korean rice and vegetable dish that's made with chicken and soy sauce. 27-year-old Korean-American Alex Jung stands over a simmering pot. He says the class taught him some new things about Korean food.
I think that I'm pretty familiar with South Korean cooking in general and all the regional differences within South Korea. And there definitely aren't that many opportunities to try, eat, or make North Korean food. And I was just excited to learn about a certain style of North Korean food that I had never eaten before.
Lee Aron says the growing availability of North Korean food in the South also has a special meaning for other refugees. She says many didn't get much of a chance to eat these dishes back home.
People in North Korea really can't eat well. They struggle because of the food shortages there. They can't have proper meals and often just have rice mixed with water. But when we work hard here in South Korea, we North Koreans can enjoy eating.
For The World, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul.
And finally today, our global hit turns it up to 11. The World's Clark Boyd profiles the Belgian power trio Triggerfinger.
Triggerfinger's been grinding out its own brand of blues-tinged rock for 12 years now. The Antwerp-based outfit's widely regarded as the best live rock band in Belgium. Ruben Block is Triggerfinger's lead singer and guitarist. He says all those years on the road, building an audience, are finally starting to pay off.
The last year with the release of our latest album, things have been going crazy in a really good way.
Triggerfinger's new album owes as much to Southern California as anywhere else. That's because Block and his bandmates, drummer Mario Goosens and bassist Paul Van Brustegen, recorded the album in Los Angeles, following in the footsteps of some rock greats.
We recorded the basics actually in the fantastic Sound City studio where Nevermind from Nirvana is recorded in the first Rage Against the Machine album, and everybody recorded there. It's the holy grail, it was amazing.
This is the title track from Triggerfinger's album, All This Dancing Around. It's become a hit on this side of the Atlantic. Block writes and performs for the most part in English. In fact, a lot of bands from the northern Dutch-speaking part of Belgium do most of their songs in English. It's just a much bigger market than the Dutch language market. Block says working in Los Angeles helped his songwriting skills as well.
Life is a little different over there, and there were certain gaps sometimes in lyrics that I still had before we left for Los Angeles. And I was walking around with my little notebook, and everywhere you hear words in little sentences that are really interesting that you don't hear here because nobody speaks the language, and I get my information out of movies and books and stuff. But it's a whole different ballgame over there.
The band's only complaint from its time in L.A.? The water in the hotel swimming pool was a tad chilly. By the way, Triggerfinger's not even considering taking a well-deserved break. The group's already got live gigs lined up throughout Europe all through the fall and into the new year. For The World, this is Clark Boyd.
I'm coming.
Music from Belgium's Triggerfinger closes our program today. Our Boston band includes Stephen Snyder and Mary Lou Ward. Rob Hugh Jones, Rahul Jugliker, and Ian Rosser are in London. The world's engineers are Robin Moore, Tina Toby, and Mike Wilkins. Our online team is led by Stephen Davey with Michael Rass and Manya Gupta. We're online at theworld.org. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Lisa Mullins. Come back tomorrow. The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Plowshares Fund, investing in peace and security worldwide, online at plowshares.org. The Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, the Freeman Foundation, and the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.